Christy. Thank you, Quint. Welcome back. Oh, no, that was me. Hey, it's good to be back home. We had Robbie and I took a trip last week to a family reunion that her family was having out west. Is anybody here from the Pacific Northwest? Anybody? Are you? Why is it so freezing there in the summertime? That makes no sense to me. It was July, and I was freezing the whole time. I don't mind the heat here, actually. I like the heat. But whoever's been praying for rain, you can stop now. This is like the summer without surfing girls. This is kind of getting me, you know, whatever. But anyway, we had a great time out there. It's a beautiful country, you know, temperatures notwithstanding. It was a beautiful place to see and visit. Anyway, this has nothing to do with what it is that I'm going to talk about, and so I'm just going to keep on going unless I fall into an old man rant or something like that. But we're going to continue our journey through the Gospel of Matthew today, and if you have a way of following along, if you'd like to head over to Matthew chapter 26, please. We've been going through the Gospel of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew has had as its major theme the introduction of the kingdom of God, how Messiah has come and the kingdom of God has invaded this earth through the agency of Jesus, who is the Messiah. And so we followed his ministry, you know, from the outset, not only from his birth, but through his ministry in Galilee, the miracles that he's done, the teachings that he's given us. And now we're in the final stages here of this 3.5 years spent traveling and teaching with his disciples. And starting with chapter 24, Jesus was talking about things coming to an end. He was talking about the end of the temple age in Israel, but he was also talking about the end of the age of this world's systems. And we referenced that the disciples were asking, you know, when is this end coming? And Jesus was talking about the temple age initially. They were saying, when is your coming? You know, when is this going to happen? And then what are the signs of your coming? In other words, what's the sign of your parousia in the Greek? It means your appearance as king. And they didn't understand it, but we understand it now that he was talking about two different things at that point, or they were talking about two different things. The temple age was going to come to its conclusion, but Jesus being revealed as king was something that is delayed. There's a space in between. They didn't recognize, we recognize now that his appearance as king is going to be a re-entrance of himself into this world. We refer to it as the second coming of Christ. So Jesus told a string of parables that described what it was going to look like while we wait for this appearance of Jesus as king, and how it was going to take longer than we thought, and how it'll happen unexpectedly. And then last week, we finished up chapter 25, and we saw how this was going to result in a division between those who were actively part of God's kingdom and those who weren't. And Matt did a great job last week, didn't he? I thought it was just outstanding. It was strange. Okay, that's enough. I'm just kidding. But it was strange to me. Oh, there he is. But it was strange to me how, you know, he's so mild and loving while he's talking and everything. And yet what he said was so convicting. I mean, for me anyway, I was just like, it was like getting hit with a brick covered in feathers or something. It was a convicting passage. I mean, the passage itself carried with it a heavy sense of a challenge from the Holy Spirit. And all of these parables that he's been telling have been like that. They were all first meant to reveal how terribly off course the religious leaders of the temple were, how far they had veered from what God's intent was, how being experts in religion had actually warped their priorities to the point that when these parables finish off, God is saying, I don't even know you. I don't even know you, the ones who were the representatives and the experts of religion. And his words, of course, are meant to challenge us today as the church, reminding us that grace and mercy and justice, those are still God's priorities. Not being religiously correct, God is interested in his righteousness, his holiness, but his grace, his mercy, his justice. Now today we're going to begin chapter 26, and we're almost at end of our study here. Believe it or not, we've been at this for like a year. Like, weren't you guys here, like the campus outreach guys who were here last year? Didn't we start Matthew last? Any of you guys, were you here last year? Oh, they're all just looking at me like, is he talking to us? Let's hope not. Just ignore him. Anyway, I just remember one of the leaders from one of the college groups was saying, oh, that's cool. You started that last year. I was like, yeah, okay, sorry. So anyway, we've been at this for almost a year. And all the at the place that we're at now, all the characters are in place. The stage, the final stage, has been set here. Everybody's in the place that they need to be. And what we'll notice is that the shadow of the cross begins to fall across all of this section that we're looking at. And if you're there in Matthew 26, we're going to begin by starting with verse 1. It says, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, these ones that we've been previously reading through chapter from starting from chapter 24, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. All right, so the stories that Jesus has been telling, when we actually look back on it, we think about the overview, you know, when he finished saying these things, and the things that he's talking about actually characterize the kingdom in a very triumphant way. You know, the king is coming back and he's setting things straight. He's putting everything in order. He's taking care of injustices. This is exactly what the disciples were expecting Messiah to do. They were looking for someone who's going to come and set things in order, set things right. And so I'm sure that their excitement about what they're involved in was beginning to grow as they hear these stories. Like, man, this is it. This is it. This is finally happening. Messiah is here. And this is, you know, God's kingdom is about to be revealed in this world. And this is going to be awesome. And I try to imagine what must have gone through their minds their emotions when Jesus finishes up those stories and then says, oh yeah, and by the way, in 2 days, I'm going to be crucified. I mean, can you imagine? They're just like, what are you talking about? How can you say something like that? They had to be absolutely confused at this point, because this is the unexpected twist to the kingdom's arrival that nobody was anticipating, that God's kingdom is going to arrive through the execution of the king. How can that be? That's like a contradiction in terms. This is the clearest statement that Jesus has made so far. He's not only explicitly saying when this is going to happen during the Passover, but he says how he's going to be executed. He's going to be crucified. He's going to be executed on a cross. And the fact that Jesus foretells this so accurately helps us to shape our understanding of this event in the Gospels. And that's an important thing for us to do, to measure that. Jesus forecast this happening. This was not just the unfortunate conclusion of Jesus' exemplary life and profound teachings. It's too bad those guys ganged up on him and killed him. Circumstances didn't crowd Jesus into a corner where he had no way of escape and they finally were able to do away with him. He was not a martyr. He wasn't even a victim. And we have to let that register a little bit. This was Jesus's path. This is where Jesus has been heading all along. This is a path that was chosen. All of the strands of Jesus's life and ministry and teaching have been leading up to this exact moment, to this time, to this event. In fact, it seems as though he's orchestrating this even around Passover. He brings up the fact that this is going to happen at Passover. There's been plenty of times where they've tried to arrest Jesus, where they tried to take him by force, where they tried to throw him off a cliff. Different things, ways in which they were going to get rid of him. It didn't happen. Jesus pulled his Messiah Jedi tricks and just got out of that whole thing. But at this moment, now, he's brought it here to Passover. And the fact that he connects it with this, the Passover, the great covenant meal for Israel, that meal commemorating God's deliverance and salvation of the Jewish people, and he connects it with that, which then tells us that all of the narratives of the Old Testament, all of that story has actually been leading us to this moment where Jesus is going to be facing this cross. All of it, the whole story has been heading here to this moment, to the cross. This is the crux of the gospel. It's the crux of the entire biblical narrative. And as the church, and especially for us as 21st century Americans, it is imperative that we not only acknowledge or recognize that, but it's imperative that we remember this, that the cross is the central revelation of God's character. We've talked about before, when we want to understand what God is like, we look at Jesus. When we understand what God is doing, we look at what Jesus is up to. And this right here, this moment, when Jesus goes to the cross, this is the chief revelation, the central revelation of the character of God. A.W. Tozer, he was a preacher, really a prophetic voice for the evangelical church some 60 years ago. He famously said, "How we understand God determines everything." And he's right on that. And especially for us who are followers of God's ways, how we understand God is going to affect everything in how it is that we carry out our lives and pursue this life of faith. For the writers of the New Testament, the cross became their chief means of understanding God. The cross of Christ is central to all of the New Testament epistles. So when we go through the New Testament epistles, every one of them is leading us back to this idea of the crucified Savior. It's, you know, Paul, Peter, James, John, they all place the cross as the focal point of their theology. And it's an intriguing thing in that there's not a whole lot of explanation as to the hows, how it all works mechanically, but every one of them point back to it saying, this is it. This right here is the revelation of God that saves us. The cross of Christ is a radical conceptualization of deity. The claim that God stooped to the place of identification with a rebellious creation this way, that took on to himself the consequences of that rebellion. This is a claim that is a departure from any other declaration of God we know of. This stands completely unique in all of the world. That's a fascinating thing just in and of itself. The cross is central to our faith because it alone is our distinctive from all other expressions of faith in the world. And if we, as the church, reduce Christianity to a set of moral commands or truths that somehow elevate our spirits, we're no different from any other religion in this world. The cross stands out in stark contrast to every other religious theological formulation or formulation in praxis. In almost every religion, sacrifice is going to play a part. You know, especially if you go back into the ancient religions, but there are some even to this day where sacrifice plays a part. But it is always with the practitioner of the religion bringing sacrifices to the deity. Always. I mean, without exception in that. I mean, in varying degrees, one way or the other. Now, there are some exceptions. I shouldn't say without exception, because there are some exceptions. Islam has no sacrificial system. Buddhism really has no sacrificial system in that sense. But even in that regard, there are many religions that encourage or even require self-sacrifice on behalf of a deity. And I don't mean like, well, in some cases, yeah, you know, human sacrifice or whatever, but even just the idea of laying down your life on behalf of a deity, you know, to serve a deity, putting yourself last in that. Hinduism, Confucianism, Islam, those are big proponents of that sort of concept. So sacrifice plays a part in the religions of the world. But the claim that the Creator God cares so much for his creation that he would go to infinite extremes of identifying with our broken state and then bearing the consequences of our sin by sacrificing himself, that is radical. There's nothing like that. There's no other framework like that in the world. Through the cross, we realize that the whole sacrificial system of the Old Testament law were simply markers pointing towards this stunning revelation of who God really is, who he really is, what he's really like, what his character is. That's like nothing else that I'm aware of. The cross of Christ, it's our pathway into the kingdom, the means of our salvation, but it's also the very way in which the kingdom is advanced in this world. The cross of Christ is central to it all through this sacrificial love expressed by God. The cross gives us a shape for the way the kingdom works. It gives us something that we can look at and immediately identify and recognize. Ah, this looks like the cross. This looks like that sacrificial love of God's character. Now we see what the kingdom is like. Now we see what God is like. Now we see how his kingdom operates in this world. It reveals God's character to us, and it's a characteristic of God's kingdom. In fact, we could say then that the cross provides the ultimate contrast between God's kingdom and the broken world's system, or the kingdoms of this world. And I love how dramatically Matthew organizes his gospel story. Jesus tells his disciples he's about to be crucified, and it's almost like a cinematic cutscene where all of a sudden now we're in the inner chambers of the religious leadership, the room of Caiaphas. He's the high priest, and they're with all the religious leaders, and they're plotting to kill Jesus. Jesus makes this prediction. We cut to this scene, and they're putting these things in order. But the contrast between kings, or the contrast between kingdoms, is vivid in this, the way Matthew is organizing this. Jesus speaks to his followers and his friends of laying down his life sacrificially in order to save them, in order to save this world, while those who cling to the world's system of power plot to take his life in order to ensure their own security. Two completely different modes of operation in play here. When Jesus, you know, in John's gospel, when Jesus stood before Pilate and made the claim that he was king, you know, Pilate's like, so you're a king. And he's saying, I am a king, but my kingdom's not of this world. Otherwise, everybody'd be here with swords and spears and there'd be a big melee going on. And when he said, my kingdom's not of this world, he wasn't trying to say it's off in space somewhere or up in the clouds somewhere or something like that. Well, no, what he's saying is my kingdom doesn't operate the way this world's systems operate, the way the kingdoms of this fallen world do. My kingdom doesn't work that way. And the thing is, the temple leaders, when we think about them there in that closed room with the other religious leaders, these leaders of the temple system saw themselves as stewards of God's kingdom. I mean, the ones who are doing this actually saw themselves as doing God's work. But they fell into step with the world's goals of nationalism and power and wealth. And then they leveraged the practices of this broken world in order to achieve their goals through political subterfuge or coercion or even killing, as it finally comes down to in their statement here. So we have to think about this. We think about the contrast here. The king who's willing to lay down his life, and then these guys who are willing to plot the murder of a man they knew was innocent, something expressly forbidden, even in the most simplistic of commands in the Ten Commandments. They were willing to do this in order to maintain their grasp on the world's kind of power, in order to maintain their position of control. And all of it, all that they're doing is done in the name of serving God. Everything that they do, they're doing in the name of being faithful to God. But God takes even this plot. He knew it. He knows the end from the beginning. He knew it all along. He known from the beginning of the world, and he transforms their plot into something more powerful than they could ever imagine. Through all of their machinations of deceit and subterfuge and plots to eliminate through force, God takes all of that and reworks it into something far more powerful than they could ever have dreamed of. The cross reveals the contrast between God's power and the world's power. God's power is transformative, redemptive, and healing. God's power looks like the cross, always looks like the cross. The cross reveals the power of sacrificial love, taking the wrong, suffering the injustice, disregarding personal safety in order that by that love you redeem the world. That's what his kingdom looks like. That's the great contrast the cross provides for us. Well, we keep reading. Verse 6. Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment. She poured it out on his head as he reclined at the table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor." But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? She's done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she's done it to prepare me for burial. Truly, I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she's done will also be told in memory of her." Okay, there's a few questions that have lingered throughout the ages about this passage. For one thing, we don't know for sure who Simon the Leper was. Leper, not leopard. It's a completely different story. Very, very ugly ending to that one. But no, Simon the Leper, this is the first time we've ever heard of him in this narrative. It's the only time he shows up this way. It's clearly his house, but if he was somebody who was still suffering from leprosy, it's very unlikely that people besides Jesus would have shown up and been there, because that just, you know, that obviously, according to the Mosaic law, was going to make you unclean. I mean, even just beyond that, you know, that's just kind of off-putting and not appealing, right? You know, hey, we're going to the leper's house to eat. It's just, if you're going to open a restaurant, don't call it leper's house. It's not a selling point, you know. Yelp, no, doesn't it? So either way, this was somebody who had been a leper. Maybe he had been a leper and Jesus healed him. Maybe that's why they're having the dinner party there in his honor, because of what had happened there. That's one possibility. The other possibility is it's just a name still attached to the house. Simon the leper is no longer around, but maybe his heirs now have the house. That's one possibility there. His heirs, according to John's gospel, which is a parallel of this narrative, it would have probably been like Lazarus and his sisters who were there, because John's gospel places Lazarus and his sisters at this event, and it actually attributes this action by the woman to Lazarus's sister Mary. So as they're reclining at dinner, Mary comes up behind Jesus, and she breaks this jar of perfumed oil and she pours it on his head. And I just have to say that as a 21st century Westerner, this whole thing is weird to me. I mean, can you imagine like being at a dinner party and the hostess comes up at some point and just dumps oil on your head and thank you. Can I use your shower now? but actually, see, that's the point. That in that time, in that place, they didn't have access to showers. They, you know, weren't capable of taking a bath at any given moment. Only the most wealthy people would have had access to baths on the daily. So the majority of the population would either bathe in rivers or in common bathhouses as they were able to, and that wasn't going to be all that often. So you have, your imagination can fill in all the blanks on this. No, that sounds all wrong. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Anyway, so welcome back, Rob. Thank you. So given the heat of that region, given, you know, like where they are, you know, we can just assume that given the heat and the amount of sweating that you would be doing, every person is probably walking around with a certain amount of odoriferous funk to them on a regular basis. So to have somebody oil down your hair, you know, make it all shiny and new looking, and that would have been welcomed. And if it's perfumed like this, all the better. Then all of a sudden we're masking the funk and everybody's getting in on it as wonderful, as beautiful. And so we can get what's happening in this. Different culture, different time period, but we get what's happening and why it's a positive thing. It's a good thing being done. Now, the details create a focus for us, and this was an alabaster jar with expensive oil in it. John's gospel has the disciples, namely Judas, quickly evaluating the price of this oil as being 300 denarii, as we could go sell this for 300 denarii. So a denarii is worth a minimum day's wage. So a day's wage for a minimum wage earner in our world would be about $56. So 300 denarii would be roughly equivalent to almost, I'm hoping my math is right, and all you math people, this is going to be horrible. All of a sudden this seems high to me. But anyway, it would be roughly equivalent to $17,000 in our economy. Are you nodding yes? Okay, yeah, that's right. Now obviously this is a loose comparison. Anybody who studies these things will tell us that, you know, there's no way that we can know dollar for dollar. But we get the picture that this was wildly expensive stuff that this lady just dumped out all over Jesus. And we know from antiquity that these types of sealed jars existed. And oftentimes they were passed down as heirlooms through a family. This was like an inheritance kind of thing that somebody would have had a hold of, like an investment provided for the family. So it's like this woman, we assume it's Mary, is giving up everything in order to express this devotion to Jesus. And once again, you know, the male disciples in the room, they don't get it. And Jesus has to correct them, explaining that what she did was actually something that was forecasting his burial. And so again, he's tying this event to the cross that he's about to go to, with the cross in view. So there we see that the cross actually inspires extravagant worship on our part. The cross needs to be central because the cross is the inspiration for us to worship and to express this kind of devotion. Now, I don't think she understood what she did as predictive of his death, but Jesus puts it in those terms. What she did was just this act of pure devotion, an over-the-top desire to express her gratitude to him, which Jesus pictures as expressive of something tied to his death. He said that what she did is going to be remembered as often as the gospel is presented. Her extravagant expression of worship pictures our response to Christ's extravagant love for us in laying down his life for us. This is an example, then, whether she understood it this way, Jesus takes it and captures it and presents it to us this way as an example of reciprocal love. She doesn't appear to pour out this oil in hopes of getting a special blessing from Jesus. Nothing is ever mentioned along those lines, or to, you know, get on his good side. Remember when I poured the oil on you, Jesus, or something. She's not trying to earn her favor from him by giving her all. No, she seems to do this from a motive of wanting to express love for him like the love she's received from him. And if we remember, we think about how Lazarus is sitting there with them, Lazarus who had been dead, whom Jesus raised from the dead. See, and so this reciprocal sense of love, that is the ultimate basis for our worship or our devotion for Christ. John puts it later on in 1 John 4:10, this is love. It's not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice that deals with our sins. God's love, expressed through the cross, inspires us to return love to him. That is the only true basis for worship. A desire to reciprocate this kind of love. You know, we don't show up here on Sunday mornings to sing songs and pray and study the Bible in order to get God to like us. You know, hopefully God will notice what we're doing here and help us out a little. No, we do this because we're grateful for the love that he's shown us. We do this because once we were dead and now we're alive, and we recognize that and we love him for that. We're grateful that he laid down his life for us to release us from that debilitating burden of guilt from sin. But you know, worship's more than that. We know that when the disciples balked at what they considered a waste, they argued that the oil could have been sold and the money given to the poor. And Jesus' response, you know, Jesus' response that the poor is always going to be with us was not intended to be like a cynical statement about the poor. You know, there's always poor people. There's nothing we can do. It's not that he's saying that. He's indicating that the timing of this was important, that Jesus was there at the threshold of the cross. You know, the poor are with us all the time. We can help them at any time, at any point of time. There's always a need there, and we can always do that, just like we were reminded of this morning during the announcement. In fact, you know, we have to even remember what was taught last week. We realize that one way in which we're going to extravagantly worship Jesus is by serving those who are most in need, because that's where Jesus identifies himself. He identifies with those most in need. So again, the cross is planted into the midst of even our good deeds. The cross sits right there in the middle of it. We do what's good or what's right in this world, not to earn God's approval, but as a response to his sacrificial love for us. He loved us to this infinite degree. I'm going to express my love to him by serving and caring for those with whom he identifies, the poor and the weak. And the cross is centric to that all. Okay, the narrative then takes another turn. It's a little more sinister. Verse 14. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. From that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. Okay, so that's where we're going to leave off the text today. It's kind of like a bummer place to leave it. But again, it's shadowed in the sacrifice of Jesus as we look at it, as we consider this. Judas is no dummy. You know, he's putting all of this together. As Jesus gets more and more explicit as time goes on, it's beginning to register with him. This is not what he originally signed up for. I mean, you know, he realizes Jesus really expects to die. He really thinks he's going to die in this whole thing. And if that's true, then everything in his mind, everything that they've been working on these last 3 years, everything they've been trying to achieve is all going to be wasted. It's all going to be thrown out. And in his mind, the waste that he just observed from Mary is symbolic of what this whole thing is about. He's just thrown it all on the ground. It was something amazing we could have achieved here, something really cool, and it's just all thrown away. All this talk of thrones and authority and things returned 100-fold, they start to fade in view for him. And I believe he comes to the conclusion that Jesus is not the Messiah that he's been waiting for. And at that moment, I believe Judas agrees with the religious leaders. I believe he looks at this and says, I've been duped. This guy is a false prophet. This guy is a faker. And so he approaches them and he asks, what will you give me if I back you now? And clearly Judas wants to get back whatever he can, you know, from his 3-year investment with Jesus. And so they offer him 30 pieces of silver, which is the exact sum that the law of Moses required as a minimum price for the life of a slave. In other words, if a slave's out in the field and he's gored by a bull, well, the owner of the bull has to pay 30 pieces of silver, the absolute minimum amount of money that you could affix to the price of a human being. That's what they offered to pay him. It's in the neighborhood, somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 in our world. Think of that, $600. And we think about this all the way around. I mean, for one, it's horrifying to think of affixing a price on a person's life, but how could he do that? I mean, how could he do that? He's been with him for 3.5 years. He's seen all the good that he's done. How could he betray his rabbi, his friend, so cheaply? Those are things, you know, we're never going to know the answer to. One of the fascinating things about the gospel is the stuff that it leaves out. And this is one of them. No details as to what his motives were, why he came to that conclusion, how he arrived at the place where he would be willing to do this at such a cheap price to betray his rabbi. We're not going to know the answer to that, but I like what N.T. Wright wrote about Judas. He says, I'm happy not to peer down into that murky well for too long because I might see reflections I find disturbing. And I agree with him on that. But one thing is for sure, stuff gets revealed in the shadow of the cross. Not only does it provide a contrast between the ways of God's kingdom and the ways of this broken world, but the cross uncovers everything that isn't sacrificial love. Just as in with the case of Judas here, the cross is actually something that's going to expose our motives. When Judas is confronted with the reality of the cross, when Jesus predicts that this is where he's going, his true colors actually come out. He doesn't try to disguise anything. He goes to the religious leaders and says straight up, what's in it for me if I betray Jesus to you? The cross represents the polar opposite of the what's in it for me mentality. The sacrificial love that's represented in the cross triumphs through surrender, never through self-gain. The cross triumphs through surrender. When the cross becomes central to our Christian journey, it's going to expose our own selfishness. It's going to bring to light any motive that isn't love just by the sheer contrast of it. You want to do something convicting? Pay attention to your life. Just for one day, pay attention to how you respond to the people in your life, to family members, to the neighbors, to the coworkers. And just keep an image of the cross nearby and measure how we respond, how we interact, what we do, what our motives are. Measure them by the cross. you'll probably give up in a few minutes. I did anyway. It's a serious contrast. And, the thing is, it might be tempting to just leave the cross out of this altogether. That's very uncomfortable. That's unpleasant. And to be honest, it seems as though, at least within popular Christendom in the United States, it seems as though that's kind of been the track. I mean, it's just painful to have our motives exposed. Let's just focus on the positive Bible promises that kind of enhance our lives or will improve our finances or something along those lines. Let's not dwell on that ugly cross. It's violent. It's ugh. But see, while the cross can expose things that are out of sync with God's character in our lives, it's also the power to reshape us into the people that God intended us to be. Because that's the beauty of it. The cross is not condemning. If it was condemning, it would just expose those areas that are flawed and out of sync and say, well, there you go. You're all sinners. There's no hope. That's condemnation. But the cross convicts and gives us hope because we know through the cross there is the power to change. There's the power unleashed in our lives as we've embraced the lordship of Jesus in our own lives, over our own hearts. By the Holy Spirit, the power to change is present, is resident. It has the power to reshape us into the people that God intended us to be. It's there at the cross that we're redeemed, we're made whole. It's in his love that, in the acknowledgement, the recognition of his love for us, that love begins to reshape our motives. In fact, it's by keeping that cross as a central view in our understanding of our own walk of faith that our lives begin to take the shape of the cross. How we respond, how we act, how we treat one another, what our priorities are, what our values are, begin to take a cruciform shape. So in our faith, in our expression of our faith in this world, in our interaction with others, and the priorities that we embrace, let's keep the cross front and center. Let's not allow this world or even cultural moors to begin to reshape that cross into something else. Let's keep the cross front and center so that by his cross we can rightly represent the love of God to a hurting humanity. So by his cross, we can find inspiration to worship him extravagantly, being willing to give all the way he gave all for us. By his cross, we can reveal to this world a love that changes everything, that ultimately is going to change this world. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please?